Welcome to Mintcast, a podcast by the Linux Mint community for all users of Linux. This is episode, the long-awaited, much-anticipated episode 241. We're recording live on Sunday, February 28th, I think is the date today, 2016. I'm Rob, the confused one. And with me on the podcast this week are both Isaac and Scott.
Yay.
Hey. Hello.
Everybody's here. We record live every other, we don't. We try to record live every other week on Sunday afternoons. Keep an eye on the Mintcast website for the schedule. Yeah, except that was wrong this time, too. Yeah. The live stream information is at mintcast.org/livestream, and we're in the Mintcast channel on the irc.spotchat.org server. If you'd see something you'd like to hear about on the podcast, head on over to the Mintcast subreddit and let us know. We actually look at that now. Really, we do. I did before the podcast. I looked at it, yep, and added a story in that I got off the Reddit I did. So anyway, later in the podcast, we're going to be talking about Linux in print. Yeah, that's that folding paper stuff that you got, but...
Dead tree.
Linux and dead trees. So you'll all remember it well. But before we do that, let's have a quick look at some of the recent and, what shall we say, not so recent
news you can use from the world of Linux. I'm Bill in Michigan, and I think Mintcast does it all.
So the big news this week.
Yeah, so the big news this week is that the Linux Mint site, or Linux Mint in and of itself, seemed to have a little bit of a problem. So apparently, I'm sure everybody's already heard this 1,000 times over. I listen to quite a few podcasts, and I feel like this horse has been beaten quite a bit. But in case you haven't heard of it, the basic summation of all this is that if you downloaded the ISOs from the Linux Mint site on Saturday, February 20th, they were... I can't think of the correct word besides hacked, but some complete loser hacked these. I'm not even going to mention his names or the fact that he did some article, any of that junk. But somebody hacked basically those ISOs, created some backdoors into them. Now, you could check to see if you have had that problem with the MD5 signatures on those ISO files to see if they match up to the valid versions. There's also been talks of how secure or whether or not that's a good idea or this, that, or the other. Clem has posted on the website and on the blog that if you best course of action is just basically to blow away your download from the 20th and then re-download it. And also notice that some stuff had happened with the forum as well. So if you're part of the forum, you for sure need to change your password. That I believe that got hacked as well. Now, how far that hack went on the forum, you know, that's not 100%. But I think it's, you know, in case you're part of that, I'm part of that. I went and changed my password as well, so I'm not for sure if you can delete your account on that or not, but
So the changing password nonsense, you know, the issue is really, so this password's out and you want to change, if you are so foolish as to use this same password everywhere that you log in on the internet, so your bank and this, your tax returns and all that kind of stuff, then you probably want to go change those passwords. They can spoof you if you want, if they want, and you don't change your Mint forum password, I suppose. But it's really, assume that that password is public and associated with your name. So if you use it anywhere else, then you should probably, well, you shouldn't have been doing that, bad on you anyway, but you should change it elsewhere.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. As far as this has happened, I'm still using Linux Mint. I think it's unfortunate that we just kind of have become I'm a little dead to some security hacks. As far as this goes right now, I'm just kind of not concerned, but I'm just making sure everybody updated accordingly, that the people I've given out computers to, and just kind of doing that number. And I pulled down some updates, and everything seems to be fine as well.
So it sounds to me like there's more to this story than the few links that, you know, I've got the one on Ars Technica, and I've kind of skimmed through some of that. The post on the the Mint website, you know, it sort of talks about, yeah, okay, that this happened. And I guess there was a bunch of discussion about it in the comments and such. Mint or Clem didn't have a lot to say about, you know, I guess I'm curious, Isaac, about what else is going on and who the person was and all that kind of good stuff. Has that all come out? And
yeah, that came out through I believe his name was Peace. I'm not for sure. He did an article. I'll dig it up for a minute and put it in the show notes. He did an article, I believe, with ZDNet, or an interview, I should say, with them about what he had done, which was basically, since Linux Mint is open source and available through GitHub, he basically pulled it down, compromised the ISO, so to speak, and then using his own server, hosted it up, and was able to have people download it through that.
And then there was a WordPress exploit, right?
I believe that's correct, too. That I need to dig more into. I've read a little bit on it, and I've just listened to a lot more on it, which basically from everybody podcast-wise, from Linux Unplugged to Luddites to Linux Voice, most people are all in the same boat of, you know, hopefully whatever the fix is, Clem will be pretty transparent about it. But a lot of everybody's kind of banding together to say that we're all a little shocked how much hate has come out towards, or people just grinding the, you know, the axe on Linux Mint, saying how it's this, that, and the other, not that good a distro, or it's a kid's distro, which none of that's true whatsoever. But it's just amazing how all that kind of came to the forefront of all this. I'm more of the boat of hopefully this will be a wake-up call to the Linux community as a whole to realize that, you know, just because Mint doesn't have the backing as some, like, say, Ubuntu or Fedora company-wise, that, you know, we'll all kind of band together to help one another out. And hopefully realize, you know, this isn't, you know, I'm afraid this is going to be the first of many. You know, of course, the distro, Linux Mint is the most popular distro. I mean, it makes complete sense for why they would target that one in particular. But the distro watch, you know, has it listed as most famous, you know, one at the current moment. And there's a lot of talk, too, about, you know, how best to go about checking your ISOs before you download anything. Because any ISO I've downloaded, everybody kind of talks about the MD5 signatures, but I believe Patty on Luddites brought up a great point that you can easily just, you know, hack that to your, you know, have it pointing at what you need it to point to. So even that's not that secure of an idea, which I've heard people bring up blockchain ideas, which I think is really good. So I think in and of itself, hopefully this won't be so much of a bashing session on Linux Mint and then more of a let's all help Mint out and each other out and so this doesn't happen again more attitude.
Yeah, it sounds like it sounds like a combination of a couple of things. So here's an excuse to bash the leader, you know, one of the more popular distributions that people are actually using. It's a distro that's used by, I guess, folks like me who are interested in using Linux but are not uber... You know, I don't compile my own kernels hardly at all, never. And so I'm more a user and maybe an informed user. And so I think Mint is specifically targeted at those kinds of people. And so if you are a person who's well familiar with the intricacies of the innards of Linux and are very knowledgeable, maybe you look at people like me and are less than impressed, if you will. And so, you know, Mint maybe appeals less to those folks and more to people like me. And so, you know, when there's a problem, people are quick to point out, well, you know, they're not doing this as well as they could. They're not doing that as well as they could. Much of which may well be true, but it sounds like there's two things going on here. There's the security or the hack of the website and the compromise of the Mint ISO, which is, you know, there's nothing on the internet that's immune to this attack from a determined attacker. But In Mint's case, it feels like that part of it wasn't actually that big of a deal. You had to have downloaded on a specific date in a fairly narrow window of time, I think. And there was a single ISO that was, you know, it was the 64-bit Cinnamon 17.3 ISO. If it was anything else, then you don't have a problem, right?
Yeah, that's exactly why I took it as well.
Yeah, so it's a fairly narrow window and a fairly small, it only really affects a fairly small number of people. So it's another one of these theoretical issues. Now, the whole other angle on this is, well, Mint is a bad distro. I'm not sure that those are connected together, although one is an excuse for the other, I suppose.
Go ahead, Scott.
I was just going to say there, you know, and we can sort of jump into another news story we have as we're talking about this, because we're sort of hedging that way. You know, I think the idea that this happened, one, it's really easy in hindsight, and we hear these stories all the time. So first off, let's not minimize the fact that this wasn't a good thing to have happen. You know, and I think we've talked about that. If in fact you got one of these, you had a backdoor, this guy had a backdoor, it was bad. It was bad. You know, it wasn't a good thing to have happen. But that saying that, we hear about exploits all the time, and companies that put millions and millions of dollars into their security systems get hacked, and things like this happen. So, you know, you can see how this might have happened and why it might have happened. Now, as Isaac said, we need to fix it, and it needs to be a case where that's transparent and that it's not just a Mint-centric thing, that it's not just Clem and team trying to go ahead and fix it. Now, the other news story we have that we're going to let you know about, and we'll have a link in the show notes, was out on InfoWorld, and it contributed to Mint's horrible, bad, awful, truly not good week that they had, where it's called, Is Linux Mint a Crude Hack of the Existing Debian-Based Distribution? And these are one of these interesting stories. It's written by Jim Lynch, who we've talked about a lot of stories by Jim Lynch, but really all it is it's a story about another story. He actually goes to there was a blog post by a guy named Globitz who went and bagged all over. Well, first got a name Globitz, so doesn't mean his opinions aren't necessarily valid, but he goes through and he just bags on Mint. A number of the different things he talks about is that, you know, it's Frank and Debian. This is stuff bolted onto Debian, but not done correctly, and the updating system is bad, and, oh, they have some names that I don't like, and those names hijack stuff, because if people want to use a utility for single host parallel shell scripting, well, that has the same name as MDM, the Mint Display Manager, so I'm going to bag on Mint for that. And Rob's going to talk about XApps in just a second. He doesn't like the fact that they're hijacking some namespace there. Well, as we've talked about, and as people are talking about in the chat as well, it became a pile-on here, and there's the comments that he had on this post, a bunch of people just start bagging on Mint and saying that it's a lot of it is not necessarily well informed either. It's people's perceptions. You know, it's always like Mint was just Ubuntu with codecs. And those of us who've been around it for a while know that's not necessarily the case. It might have been when our very first version 5 or 6 or whatever it was, but it hasn't been that way for a long time now. There are some good responses in here where people talk about Cinnamon and being a great desktop and you know, basically sheltering people from the decisions that Debian made with GNOME 3. And how the direction they went, and how Cinnamon preserved that sort of the classic desktop with a lot of updating. But again, it just seems like, as we're seeing in the show notes, it was sort of a pile out. A bunch of haters came out, and I think a big piece of this is the fact that Mint is somewhat simplified. If you compare it to things like even a Fedora out of the box, takes a whole lot more work and knowledge of your operating system than Mint does. But certainly compared to things like Arch, and you guys experienced Arch just on a recent episode, and you know what that means. but so I think we have haters coming out saying, oh, this is, you know, as you said, a kid's distribution. And again, it's popularity. Anytime there's some popularity, you're going to get some of that. You're going to get people who are hardcore Linux folks are going to say, well, you know, if it's not command line, it's garbage. It's not true Linux. And, so I think this stuff is easy. I think easy to bounce back from. I think Mint will continue to be popular. And articles like this don't really, and blog posts like this don't really go a long way to knocking that down. The security hack, depending on how much publicity and how well Mint responds in a transparent fashion, as we talked about, could be more damaging than something like an article like this.
Yeah, I agree. So I don't want us to come across as, you know, Mint can do no wrong and such, because I think whenever things like this happen, the strength of the team is shown by how they react to it. And you know, so hopefully we learn something, and I say we like I'm part of it, but hopefully the development team is able to kind of look at what was done, decide, you know, what reasonable changes need to be made, and then do something that would help mitigate this in the future. That's kind of all you can do. I will say I thought that they, at least from what I could see, you know, Clem was very active in the forums immediately after it happened, once they came back up again, and responding to people and talking about what had happened. So I don't, you know, it didn't sort of disappear into obscurity where nobody on the project was talking about it, the way that these things sometimes do. So that shows some maturity, I think, and some reasonableness in terms of the way they behave, the way they responded. So, you know, hopefully we get past this and the guys put things back together again, and you know, we go back to doing what we were doing, don't, you know, give the script kiddies any more publicity than they really deserve. We've probably done that already, given them too much publicity. So, moving on, let's talk about XApps. So, XApps are, there's sort of a name for something that, unless you sort of study up a bit on desktop environments, it's like, really? What are we doing this for? So, We talked about Mint being derived from Ubuntu, and that Cinnamon sits on top of a GNOME 3 base. And so what's happening is, and so what they did is they took a lot of the GNOME, generic GNOME applications, you know, gedit and all the things that you just kind of use, the text editor and the music player and that sort of stuff. And those are incorporated into Linux Mint. And so what's happening with GNOME is that they are, of course, moving along with GNOME Shell and GNOME 3 and are moving all of the applications that are built in the GNOME environment along with that. And so they're changing the user interface guidelines and changing the APIs that are used to generate, basic elements of the user interface, you know, menus and title bars and you know, decorators and things like that are all moving to look and be consistent with GNOME 3 and GNOME Shell. Now, Cinnamon, of course, is specifically designed to not do that. Cinnamon is specifically designed to look like, or to keep the look and feel that is different than GNOME Shell and such. And so this was creating more and more of an issue for the Mint team. And so that's the idea for an XApp. So an XApp is an application that is built on modern GTK, so they're going to use GTK 3, but uses a traditional UI, title bars, menu bars, things like that, rather than what might be coming or might be moving to becoming more common in GNOME Shell. They want it to be generic and just preserve kind of what is already there. So that's where XApps are coming from and why they need to exist, as far as I can tell anyway. So these were announced a month or so ago that they were going to do this. The first two of them that are going to be ready are the text editor and the media player. So the text editor is based on the existing or based on the GTK version of Pluma, which is, I want to say, a fork from gedit from lo these many years ago. Same functionality and UI as was in gedit 2.3, apparently. So, you know, and the interesting thing about these XApps is I think when they roll out, you might not notice that they rolled out. And that's exactly the point. It won't look different. The point is to preserve what's there. And the Media Player app is going to be based on Totem 3.1. So it's going to provide the same UI, same plugins for that Totem 3.1 did, or 3.10 did, rather. And so these things are probably going to pop out relatively early. I'm not sure when they're expecting that they're actually going to be available for people. But they are on their way and can only be, I can only assume that these things are good indicators of the long life that is to come for the traditional UI that Cinnamon's wrapped around. So this is good stuff, I think. Did I kill it dead?
No, you didn't.
Did I kill you guys dead?
No,
was that
I
bad?
Agree. They're going to roll out.
I've left them speechless.
Yeah, I agree. They're going to roll out. I'm looking forward to them. And I think the first one, I'm a big fan of Pluma, so I'm ready to see them.
Yeah. The thing about text editor for me is it's just part of the background. You know, it's just always there. You get so used to using the thing that when I go on to another distro and it's, this is not gedit, this is something different. Oh, I got to go figure out what this is. It's not that it's bad or hard to use or anything. It's just not what I normally use. And so the notion that these things might go away or start to work in a radically different way is not all that attractive to me. I suppose I could learn, but, you know, you get very stayed or stuck in your ways. I'm a nano. I use nano in the command prompt, and I use gedit or Pluma or something that looks like that in the GUI, and it just is there. That's just what I do. So I'm looking forward to them staying there. Okay, so what else we got in the news? We got some stuff in the war for the desktop. So, So Ubuntu's announced the tablet is where we're going. So Ubuntu.com/tablet, Ubuntu for tablets. Everything you need from a PC in a tablet. All the power of a PC in your tablet, at home, at work, on the move. I don't know what to make of this, other than, yeah, okay, so we've been talking about tablets forever, and we've listened to people talk about, oh, yeah, I bought this ABC brand X tablet, and I installed Ubuntu on it, and it sucked. Okay. So now Canonical's going to announce it. They've got a tablet. So coming soon on the BQ Aquarius M10, the world's first Ubuntu tablet, is soon to be available for sale all over Europe, direct from the manufacturer BQ. Wait, all over Europe? Why? The Europeans need tablets more than everybody in the world does? Or they can only get them in Europe, maybe? Or anyway, looks like a truly middle-of-the-road tablet. 10.1-inch display, full HD video camera, 2 gigs of RAM. Yeah, it looks like it's an okay tablet. 16 gigs of internal memory plus a micro SD slot. So this is not going to set the world on fire. But it is Ubuntu, and it is running on a tablet, and it looks like you can connect it to a keyboard, mouse, monitor, and use it as a full PC. I don't know. Are you going to go buy one of these things, anybody?
If they show up in the States, I will.
Yeah, register your interest. So does this BQ Aquarius M10, does this already exist? Is this an already existing piece of hardware that you can go look at? Or yeah, it depends on the price. I agree, Swift 110. It really depends on the price. If this thing's $599, it's like, nope, don't think so.
Yeah, I think Swift 110 hits it again with the only after it's been reviewed, because you know, you see these things and there are a lot of tablets out there that the hardware just doesn't cut it, and so no matter what you put on it in terms of an operating system, it's not gonna be that great. And I don't know, you know my opinion about all these things that Ubuntu and Canonical have been trying to do, and it's not a game changer. They're way, 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 way too late to be a game changer. And they're not going to have the distribution. It's going to be a hobby. It's going to be a hobbyist's device.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So is it going to be better than Android on a tablet? Because, you know, I use an Android phone for my personal phone. I have an iPhone as a work phone. And I have this HP touchpad that's got Android installed on it. And I have to say, of those three devices, the most reliable, bulletproof device is the iPhone.
Yeah.
My Android phone, I continually am running into goofy little things that just don't work. Like I've just stumbled across Bluetooth. Bluetooth audio on Android just doesn't work. And I don't know what it is. And you go look on the internet, and oh, yeah, it's all over the internet. Everybody knows Bluetooth doesn't work on Android. So I can't, you know, I'm listening to an audiobook. Well, I got to do that on my iPhone because my Bluetooth headset doesn't work properly with my Android phone. So if this tablet, if Ubuntu will work better on a tablet than Android, I'm all over that. That's got to be a winner, I think.
I think that's
how they'll win.
I agree with Scott. I think they're super late to the game, and not just, in my opinion, I hope it works well on a tablet, but I've heard many, many people put their app store down saying that's the worst part of this whole deal, and that's where they're going to be losing the game, and they're way behind the tablet, don't get me wrong, and the phone situation too, but they're super behind on the app store concept, and that's where Android, and equally the iPhone, but really Android, like puts the gauntlet down. Like they're going to be a lot of time catching up. So even if it does run super well and the apps aren't any good, then I don't see the point in it. So we'll just hopefully, I mean, if I ever get a chance to buy one, I guess I'll have to move to Europe to go buy one, but whenever the day comes, we'll find out.
Yeah. So, you know, Ubuntu on a tablet though, is it Linux or is it, you know, so if it's Linux, then I don't need no stinking app store. I got Linux, man. I got everything I need on Linux. I don't worry about Linux Mint because it doesn't have a good app store. It's got the whole repository, for heaven's sakes.
Well, just go buy a Raspberry Pi at that rate. If you just got Linux.
Well, no, the problem with the Raspberry Pi is that the repo is not big enough. There is stuff that's available on Linux. It's not available on the Raspberry Pi that I can't get to work there anyway. But if this is Ubuntu, and if I've got the full Ubuntu repository behind it, I suppose that's what really matters is do I have the full gamut of Linux software available?
I don't know.
Yeah, that'll be what drives it. So we'll keep an eye on that one. If it's $600, I'm just saying I'm not going to buy one.
Oops, sorry, I had the mute button.
I hate
talking
when that
away.
Happens.
I had, no, nice, you had, I had worked
missed
nice,
your best stuff too.
Oh, great segue worked out and everything. But anyways, we're just going to let that drop. And speaking of letting things drop, it looks like the SCO versus IBM legal battle might finally be over.
No, say it's not so. What are we going to all talk about if that's over?
Well, you know, every couple of months we need to have a story. We'll just talk about how it's still over.
It's still over, yeah. It was over last...
Still over. In fact, I think last time we reported on it was that it was probably going to be over. But now it's even closer to being over than it was last time we reported on it. There was actually a... The judge who's been working on this thing since the case was reopened in 2013 actually just the other day came out and said that all of SCO's claims against IBM are dismissed and that all briefs for a final legal certification of the judgment would be due last Friday. And if there's responses, they'll come on March 11th, and that should be it. So
did his kids just graduate from university or something? Is that why we're ending
be,
it?
Could be. Yeah. So this was, as you guys may recall, this thing started in March of 2003. And SCO was originally asking IBM for $1 billion in damages. And they were holding hostage anybody who was running Linux because they said that it infringed on that they had stolen, Linux had stolen code from Unix, from the Unix patents that they had gotten from Novell. And I'm not going to redo the whole case, but SCO went from losing streak to getting judgments against them to going out of business. They actually do exist right now. They don't sell anything. The only reason they exist as a corporate entity right now is to chase this particular lawsuit. So it feels like the fact that they have totally lost it, that I think they're going to be out. They originally filed for bankruptcy protection back in 2007. Nine years ago. And yet this thing still drags on. So, but it looks like it very well may be done by March 11th, done and over. So we can only hope.
What a sad end to a company.
Yeah, it was Santa Cruz Linux. If you guys remember, Santa Cruz Linux was actually a pretty good distribution at one point
early,
in time.
Early on, yeah.
Yeah, yep. Yeah, way back in the day.
It's sad to see it end up that way.
Yeah, yeah. This is, let all patent trolls beware. This is where, this is the fruits of that type of endeavor.
It's where we hope you all end up.
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. So we get the election going on. Isaac, what are we going to do here?
I guess we're going to open source our voting technology. It seems that we got another piece of news here. It seems that in San Francisco, where I guess all the really cool companies are nowadays, they are in somewhat of, I guess, heavy talks to see about using more like a voting system that's not so much the fiasco of the hanging Chad stuff of 2000, which I still can't believe we're still like referencing that. But
wow.
The problem here is they want to, since that all occurred, there's always been talks of taking voting to the tech realm, and I guess to the online realm. But the problem with that becomes who's going to supervise that technology and then sell it to each other, and then the whole fiasco of businesses goes so on and so forth attitude. So they've decided, or at least have voted, that they're wanting to push this to be an open source concept for the voting there. And I believe they're trying to push it through the chains so that it will be available by 2019, which I guess that would put us for some congressional voting. I don't know exactly. I'm not really that big a voter.
Well, 2020.
Yeah. So hopefully it will be. I guess they're hoping for this. I don't see it being available by then. I see that the talks currently are, seems like they're starting to move forward a little bit. They are starting to debate it, and it's good that they're at least taking it to the open source realm. But I don't know. I'm being a little jaded here. I don't see this working out. I don't even think this is honestly a good idea.
Well, I was going to say, I wonder if the guys who got at the Linux Mint ISO know that this is going to go ahead in San Francisco. Maybe there's some stuff they can do there.
Yeah, I mean, I like the idea of it being, if we're going to do it, it has to be open source. If not, that's really, really scary what it would be like if it wasn't open source. So I really think the idea isn't too bad. I don't know. I'm still not sold. I think this is voting is something we shouldn't take into account for this.
So I'll take the flip side, because I think you have to take advantage of technology, and we will be taking advantage of technology as we move forward with voting, and it has to be open source. All you got to do is Google voting irregularities with voting machines, and there are people who, every election cycle it goes on, And if you start, if you dig into it a little deeper, what will happen on the election cycles is people will say, oh, no matter what I did, I couldn't vote for the Republican candidate. It kept going to the Democratic one, or vice versa, or, you know, whoever. I just couldn't get my, I couldn't get it to take my selection. And these stories come up every election cycle since we've started to use electronic voting. Now, I think Diebold is one of the companies that makes voting machines. And if you Google that and election machine irregularities, it's very scary. Vote counts coming out of the machines, just all this stuff. And it's all black boxed. In mm-hmm. fact, it's black boxed, and there's protections in it to keep it black boxed. And if the people who are piling on Linux Mint for server security 101, you look at what these guys are doing, and it seems like they've never taken a security class in their lives. So I think it has to be open source. I think we're going to go there no matter what. It's going to happen. And so I think it has to be open source, so there's transparency in the code and that people can understand what's going on behind the scenes when they push that button.
I totally agree with you, Scott. It has to be open source. This reminds me of a Simpsons episode where Homer voted, and it was like voted for the wrong person. And then when he hit it again, it was like three votes for the other guy, and it kept adding up exponentially.
Oh dear, you know, the hanging. We got to bring the Chads back. That's I think the only real way to do it. To be sure,
the butterfly ballot. Yes,
butterfly ballots. There you go. Yeah. That's exactly right. Yep. Well, I think we probably beat the news more good and proper to death than we even need to. So let's see if I can find my way over here. We'll transition over and have a look at our actual main topic. We were kicking around this idea about Linux in print. So, you know, if you've been around the Linux world for a length of time, you probably have a big stack of Linux books laying about, and maybe even some magazines and stuff. We thought we'd talk about kind of what everybody does and what we use. So I'm going to let Isaac lead us off here, since I think this topic is actually your fault, Isaac. So we're going
to
make
they
you
all
talk
seem to
about
be my
it.
Fault at some point.
Yeah,
but
I got some stuff to talk about, but you seem to actually use this stuff.
Yes. Yeah. So the point of this main topic is just so that you, the listener, if you've been listening, when I first started listening to Linux Mint, and also got more into Linux, I had some of the words were getting tossed around. I had no clue what was what. And it was through, I'm an avid reader, big bookworm, huge proponent of the library. And it's through books and magazines normally that I'm able to, you know, eventually get a hold on the concept and take off. So, you know, here at my house and at work, I own a ton of books related to, like, Java, Raspberry Pi, Arduino, JavaScript, software, design, code, you name it. I own a ton of books. And there's a few on Linux. Now, I find for coding aspects, print books work out really well. And I do own some Linux print books, but a lot of books I own are equally ebooks. So I'm an ebook reader, big on that whole number. So we'll just kind of run off the list, and I won't go through too much of my list. I'll go pretty quick through it, but I'll just run through what I read. I wouldn't say a normal basis, but what I would point to for anybody that's currently, hey, Isaac, I want to get into Linux, but I have no clue where to start. And this would be like my, I guess, top 10 or top whatever list of what you need to do. So as far as magazines are concerned, I myself read Linux Journal, and I also read Linux Format. Now, Linux Journal, I've been reading for about a little over a year now, and I really like the magazine. It's not, they don't really go too much into the, I guess, the hoorah of advertising that one of my other software magazines has nothing but advertising, I feel like, in it left and right. So it's a real simple magazine. Highly recommend checking out Linux Journal to see what you think about it. And then the other one would be Linux Format. And that one I really, really recommend. And Linux Format got me up to speed super quick with Linux concepts and terminology. And I honestly cannot say enough good things about that magazine. So if you feel like you're being overwhelmed when you first walk into the Linux world, or any Linux podcast you listen to is just nothing but gibberish, then I highly recommend checking out Linux Format, because they kind of take you through the steps. Now, here in America, you can go to Barnes & Noble, I do anyway, and you could see that there are several Linux magazines, but they cost through the roof, mainly because most of these are getting published in Europe. And Linux format, I found that ebooks, or e-magazines, I guess, are a lot cheaper than the published. Now, you might not get, I know Linux format ships with a CD on all their issues with distro of the month or distro they're talking about and highly recommend you look into. So if you want to get a little bit cheaper subscription, check out the ebook, the e-format of whatever these journal or format. But if you're looking for print and would like to equally just get a distro every month, then check out Linux format. Now, as far as books, I'm going, probably the worst book I ever read was Linux Mint Essentials. So
yeah, but you know what? That the reviewers on that book was so well reviewed for technical content.
Do we know anybody that was involved in this?
If you look at the contributors, there's some handsome guys in there. Yes.
Is that right? Is that on the online thing that it says who this book is for? What you will detail? I don't see anything about contributors.
You gotta get the print copy.
I mean, you can.
Oh, I actually have to pay money to find out who the contributors are.
You can read about Turing and Jobs and all these worthless people that contributed nothing, or you can read about some real people that did a great job for us and read Linux Mint Essentials.
technical reviews. Yes.
I mean,
so just a disclaimer, in case you guys haven't figured it out, I was one of the technical reviewers for Linux Mint Essentials. So,
yep, and I totally recommend that book, and not at all because of Scott. It's more of, it is honestly a good read from A to Z, and it covers honestly every aspect of Linux Mint. I feel like everything you might come across. It's a really good book. I've definitely thumbed through it several times when I've had a random issue or was wondering about a way to do something. So I would highly recommend to all of our listeners to check that book out for sure. Now, that is for sure the only Mint-centric book I've ever seen. And if there is any more, they don't do nearly a good enough job as that book does. Now, if you're looking to get into what Linux is in and of itself and its heart and soul, then two books I'd recommend are Linux System Programming and Understanding the Linux Kernel. Both of them will take you a very deep dive into what is Linux. And they're really good. They can get super boring. If you're looking to fall asleep, I would definitely check them out. But they're really good, too, if you're looking to get the nit and gritty of what is Linux. When it comes to shell scripting, I would definitely recommend the Bash Pocket Reference and then also learning the Bash Shell, which is, I believe, by O'Reilly. Every book I feel like O'Reilly does is usually worth its weight in gold. Both of those books helped me definitely one-up my Bash knowledge, so I would check them in those out. And then to somewhat round out that list there, a couple honorable mentions. As far as books go, there's just too many. But honorable mentions for magazines would be Linux Voice. The only reason I don't subscribe to them is because I already listen to their podcast on a daily basis. But I think I might change that. There's also Linux User and Developer, which I used to read, and I am not 100% sure why I stopped reading that magazine. I don't know. Maybe I was subscribed to too many, and that one just got called out. And then, of course, the Magpie, which is, I know all about Raspberry Pi, but it has a ton of great Linux knowledge that will come in handy at some point in time, and that is another great read. And that one you could get for free off their website, I do believe. So that is my top books of helping you one up your knowledge in Linux.
So I did some looking into this before the podcast as well. My history, I'm much older than Isaac is, and so I can remember back to the Book of the Month Club, and so I was the member of a computer Book of the Month Club years ago, back when books were relevant. And so the deal was, they'd send you a book every month, and if you wanted to keep it, you just sent them money, or if you didn't want to keep it, you just sent them the book back. It was a great deal. And so I accumulated a whole pile of just random books that I probably wouldn't have actually paid money for, except for that club. And so when you look at my Linux book collection, it dates back to that vintage of books. Magazines, I subscribe to magazines, but I don't now find magazines to be especially useful anymore. And we can maybe kick this around a little bit, but I read PC Magazine back in the day when every issue of PC Magazine weighed several pounds. They were just ginormous things. It was you know, 60% advertising, and they were 300 pages long. It was like a novel. At the time, there weren't really any good Linux magazines, and so, you know, there wasn't anything to subscribe to. And these days, what I find is the internet is such a rich information source that the kind of content that I used to read in magazines, I find that mostly I read that online now. So that said, Linux Journal is a magazine that I had a subscription to some time ago when they were they're now a digital-only magazine. But before they went to digital-only, I had a subscription. And it was relatively inexpensive, which is probably why they went to digital only, because it's too expensive to keep a print magazine going. I'm not currently a subscriber. I've kind of let that slide. I'm not kind of reading it a whole lot. I read their online content, but I don't read so much of their print content anymore. And then the internet is the other main magazine I read. You know, there's a lot of stuff that that's where I get most of that kind of content, news and articles about stuff. You know, I get it on the off the internet. So books. What books do I have? Well, the first one I'll mention is one by Rox, I think, WROX, and it's called Beginning PHP Apache MySQL Web Development. This was my first introduction to the LAMP stack, the idea of a LAMP stack and what it was and how you could use it. And it's still, if you're going to work in PHP, it's still a really, I think, a good reference. It's probably available free online. A lot of these books are that way now. Another book that I put a lot of time into was one called Core Python Programming. Now, I have the second edition. I think there's a third edition out now, but that was kind of my first serious introduction to Python. And then to round out the non-Linux collection of books, Programming Collective Intelligence is another book that I just loved. It is all full of examples of how things in what was then called Web 2.0 were actually done. It talks about you know, how do these things that the you know, if you bought this book, you'll probably like these other two books. How do those actually work? Those recommender systems, and there's an airline travel system that's in there. There's just a bunch of really interesting sort of crowdsourcing, you know, there's got a Twitter aggregator in there. How do you go find out a bunch of stuff about Twitter? So lots of analysis kinds of programs. A couple of my early Linux books, which these ones are from the mid 90s. One is Learning Debian GNU Linux by Bill McCarty, and it's so old that it's available online for free now. I think I had an old Red Hat Linux book, which I threw out. It came with Red Hat Linux 6 or 7, maybe. Something really old, anyway. And, of course, I have a book, the Running Linux, Matt Welsh and Lar Kaufman book. It's on the fifth edition now. I have the first edition from 1985. It's not worth anything. It's the first edition. It's just old. I also have one that's called Teach Yourself Linux Programming in 24 Hours.
And the Sam, is that the Sam's books?
That's the Sam's books. Yep. There's 100 of those things around. This one's all about C programming for Linux. I have to say, I never used it much. I have about 6 or 7 C books all the way from Kernahan and Ritchie through to Numerical Methods in C. So I've got a whole raft of C programming books. From back before Python existed and such. This is the only Linux
back when it was B.
Back when it was still B. No, I never actually programmed in B. As a matter of fact, I started with C, being an advanced sort of guy. And then I also have about a dozen books on C and C++ and C# and VB.net, and of course I have my requisite copy of volumes 1 through 3 of Knuth's The Art of Computer Programming. So if you have not read those books, you really need to sit down and put yourself to sleep sometime. Or TAOCP, as it's commonly called in the business, you know. And I've also got a bunch more AI and robotics books that I can shake a stick at. So, but you know, you look at the list of books, and I think the most recent of these things is probably 7 or 8 years old. But when I look at the books that I'm actually using, the source books, textbook type stuff that I'm using, it's all online free. You know, you want programming Linux programming Linux, beginning Linux programming. There's a Rocks book that's available as a PDF online. You want to learn about Python. There's a half a dozen full Python books online. Software Carpentry, great book on how to do software development. And the same thing with magazines. So, you know, I've really come to the conclusion that I don't really know how any of these folks are staying in business. You know, the guys from Linux Format left and started Linux Voice. And they seem to be doing really well, and I'm absolutely astounded. I cannot figure out how they're actually making that thing take off. You know, how are they staying alive? This I don't understand, because I don't really understand what is the business model for a print magazine in the internet age. So how's that for a lead-in, Scott? Can you answer the question, the value of a print magazine in the internet age?
People like having things in their hand.
Ah, that's what it is.
That's
yes.
Why my daughter won't get a Kindle. Because she likes having stuff in her hand.
She likes a real book.
Yeah. So, and just to echo what you guys have already heard, I too like Linux Format. I've had a prescription to that for years now, and still do. I also enjoy Linux Voice. And they're very similarly, it's interesting that when the guys left and started doing Linux Voice, they structured their magazine in a very similar fashion. And I think that the Linux Format guys did a great job in replacing the folks who left and are still putting out a good magazine. And Linux Voice is, it's definitely, if you're trying to choose between the two, take a look at either one. I think you can't go wrong. They both do stuff from beginner to advanced in a single magazine. And as Isaac said, they can help you get up on terminology. They both do they used to have a Dr. Brown's Administriva or something like this in Linux Format before the team left to do Linux Voice. And he would get into highly technical subjects that were really advanced. And then you could go and do a tutorial on how to print, you know. So you can see that in the same magazine. So it really did. And they always have great picks of software and things like that. They do reviews and roundups of, they'll do comparison of like four different applications that do the same thing and give you their choice. So both of those magazines, really, really good. And Magpie as well. I like the fact that you mentioned that, Isaac, because now that I'm mucking around more with my Raspberry Pi, you get ideas out of there. You see what people are doing. You get ideas for add-ons and additional hardware that you can get and do advanced stuff with your Raspberry Pi. And they also do simple programming stuff. So in programming, you learn more about the operating system in that way too. So those are all good. Now, as far as books go, I'm also one of these people who has, it's really interesting because we're in the process of moving, and I actually had to go find the box that I put the books in, open it up, and make sure I had them in front of me so I could recommend them. And I have a couple that they're really good beginner's books or really good starter books, but they also have a ton of information in them, so they're not just for beginners. One is, I'm going to grab it right here so I can read it off, A Practical Guide to Linux Commands, Editors, and Shell Programming, and this is by Mark Sobel. And he's done a couple of different editions of this, and it's a pretty thick book, but it has a lot of information in it and really does a nice job. And he gets into, like I say, into shell programming as well. So not only does he talk about Linux, but he gets into that. Another one is the Linux Administrator's Guide, Beginner's Guide for Linux Administrators, and that's a great one. It also talks about both the operating system itself and scripting to automate processes in the system itself. So those are great ones. Now, there's a particular publisher who I really like, and I found myself buying more and more of their stuff, and that's No Starch Press. and you guys have probably seen them. They sort of do, their covers are sort of 50s Art Deco type of artwork, and they have a number of a few of them that I bought, and these aren't specifically Linux, but Absolute BSD was a great title. They also have a title, The Debian System. Now, it's probably a little dated because I don't know if they've done updated editions of it, but really, outside of System D, a lot of the concepts are exactly the same as they've been for a while, and it's going to give you a great understanding of how Debian works, and obviously Debian's the basis of Ubuntu, Mint, and a bunch of other distributions. And the last one I wanted to talk about from No Starch Press is a great one. I would highly recommend this. It's called The Linux Command Line, A Complete Introduction by William Schatz. And this came out just a couple of years ago, and it's a fantastic book. It's really going to help you. It'll start you off at the command line. It's not totally stupid, you know, saying, okay, this is a, you know, but it'll give you enough information that when you go to the command line, you're going to feel totally comfortable and you're going to start using it a lot more. And it's really well done. So I would highly recommend The Linux Command Line. You know, Rob talked about using the internet, but I like when I can sit with a book in my hand and in front of my operating system and start doing stuff. I look at the book, I peck away, I do a few things, I go back to the book and kind of work that way. I'll use the internet for quick hits and trying to discover stuff. And of course, every time you have a question, it's a great place to find the answer. But certainly enjoy going through these books and definitely enjoy the technical books. I have a whole bunch of programming books as well, and Mastering Regular Expressions. And I would recommend the O'Reilly books for if you're into programming or you want to get into programming. The O'Reilly Press has a ton of books. The cookbooks are always great. I don't know if you've ever used those, Rob or Isaac, but the O'Reilly Press cookbooks are always good for learning concepts or solving issues when you're trying to do stuff programming in a different language and things along those lines. So you know, it's interesting. I was thinking about it when somebody suggested Linux in the press, Linux in print. Rob and I have been doing this show for a long time. We've never done this topic, and it's really one that I've referred to a lot of times. Sometimes our subject matter or my opinions on a different topic that we're talking about will come directly out of some of the magazines or books that I've read. And so I think it's you know, we talk about is you know, is this the dead tree? Is print dying? But I think it's very relevant, and I think. You know, unfortunately, you go into Barnes & Nobles now, there's probably not as many computer books as there were before, but I still think there's a lot out there, and you know, with Amazon and such, you should definitely avail yourselves of the free ones that Rob talked about, and then you know, buy one or two and support the authors and educate yourself with Linux and print.
Yeah, there's a couple of things I want to add to what you just said, Scott, which is the cookbooks, yes, you are correct, are very good. Also, for any of our listeners who have a job that you're doing development for a bigger company, I find that if you ask your manager, hey, can I get reimbursed for buying a book that will help me better my job, they will happily do that for you. And that's how I've gained a lot of books over the years, is just asking, yep, can someone buy this for me? Because if I learn this, because currently I'm going back through the ringers of Java 8, needing to know that like the back of my hand. But they're willing to buy me all the Java 8 books I can ask for.
Yeah, typically IT departments will have what they call a subs and pubs budget line item, and subscriptions and publications. And as you said, if you're willing to do self-study inside your job, most managers are willing to support that because it's cheap. It's a cheap way to get for a resource for an employee to gain additional skills.
Yeah, you bring up a good point, Scott, about the programming with something in your hand. And Rob, I guess that would be my, not a counterpoint, but when you're talking about magazines and you got the internet, nowadays when I'm doing anything with the internet, it is very specific. Now, I mean, no longer the days of I'm just going to search and see what's going on, you know, in the world. I'm very much like, how do I do this lambda to remove this from that? It's very, very much all my I'm just very specific nowadays on the internet, and that's all I'm looking for. But magazines now afford me this, especially Linux Format and Voice, and the Magpie falls in with this as well. Those three guys are great about, hey, by the way, have you tried out whatever version of distro, or they do such a realm of covering things for me that gives me a chance to experiment or looking at concepts I never normally would, because I'm so narrow. I hate it. I'm very narrow minded on the internet, and Google accordingly knows this. It keeps me narrow minded as well. So I don't really go outside the realm, and that's what the magazines normally afford me, a chance to step out of the box.
Yeah, that is really true. You know, you one of the downsides of the internet is so the good thing about the internet is if you ask a question, you will find that this is a question somebody else has asked before and that there's an answer there. The bad thing about the internet is if you don't ask a question, then it doesn't give you the answer. And magazines and books to a certain extent as well tend to kind of take you places. You know, you say, well, I want to read everything that you have to write for me this month. And some of that I would have known to ask for, some of it I wouldn't. So it's a good way to do that. There are a few magazines around like the Magpie that, that are just out there available for people to download. And, I think the issue with print magazines, I think, is you have to come up with some use case that doesn't work in the online world. And for me, that use case always involves, sitting on an airplane or sitting someplace where I don't necessarily have access to the internet or access to a reader device. I have pretty much stopped now reading fiction books in print. I've turned over almost exclusively now to Kindle books. That's the only way I ever read anything is on the Kindle. So I'm a bit like your daughter, Scott, or a bit the opposite, I guess, to your daughter, that that is about the only way I read anymore, because I find that I'm capricious enough in my tastes that I can have four or five books on the go all at the same time, and I carry them all with me all the time, plus another dozen or two dozen books that looked interesting that I took out of the library or downloaded from someplace and just haven't got around to reading yet. So I always have a choice of 20 or 30 books that I can read just by carrying that Kindle.
Yeah, I agree with that, Rob. I want to say real quick, too, that one reason I love ebooks, but I find that when it comes to specifically not so much Linux, but very much programming, I need a physical book in my hand. I've bought a couple of ebooks that did horrendous jobs of formatting, and I couldn't decipher what was going on. And then also, I do a lot of flipping back and forth to make sure I'm tracking on what needs to occur with any tutorial. And I find with some ebooks it's good, but I have more bad use cases than good use cases when it comes to programming specifically on ebooks.
Yeah, and I think, a couple of people have mentioned it in the chat as well. Don Sears mentioned, he likes to mark up books with post-it notes and yellow highlighters. Yep. And that really is true, and I do the same thing. I look at my programming books, and they all have little things stuck in there with something's circled and highlighted. And that's harder to do, or maybe impossible. No, it's not impossible to do, but it's certainly harder to do with electronic books, and it's harder to find things. The thing that is easier to do with an ebook is to search inside the book for, I know what was talking about this, so let me go find that. And you can find it easier in an ebook. But so it feels like to me that what we're concluding is that, well, books and magazines, dead tree books and magazines probably have a place. They certainly have had a place in all of our existences and will continue to have one. So be interested in people's feedbacks. We'll put a link to a lot of these books that we've been talking about in the show notes, and you can add your own to it as well. So I think that's gonna kill us for the main topic. Or at least, yeah, maybe the truth is it kills the main topic for us. That would be a better way to say that. Yeah, I'm not sure exactly what happened there. But in any case, So, in spite of the fact that we have been a month since our last episode, let's see, what have we got in here now for, well, let's see if we got some mail. No mail. Okay. That's all right, really. We're not complaining, so lest you feel guilty because you haven't emailed us. That's not an issue. We have been quite busy, of course. So, anyway, not much in the old mailbag. So let's take a couple of minutes and just catch up on anything that's going on with each of you guys. So what happened last podcast? I was on a cruise in the Caribbean, so wasn't thinking at all about Linux, and I came back and found out that these guys decided it was Valentine's Day, so we didn't have to do a podcast.
There was a lot of we thought we could get away with some things, and significant others appeared and were like, "You really gonna podcast on Valentine's
Day? You're gonna do what? Don't you know that this is Valentine's Day? You're gonna do what? No, you're not."
Looking back on it,
that's kind of how I went down.
Yeah, I wish we would have done like Linux in Love or something like that, or a love of Linux on that day. Looking back on it, Linux. I really wish we would have done that.
Well, you know, you guys should have just gotten all your significant others in the room and just had a discussion among them about Linux and its effect on interpersonal relationships, shall we say.
That's how you build a strong relationship, is you code in Linux together.
People who code together stay together. Yes, that's what I say, you know. Oh, yes. Well. All right. Well, we reached near the end of our time together. Let's see. What else we got on here? Oh, we got a website. Look at that. We got a website.
Yep.
Cool.
We got a... two websites. One building on the main topic is Packet Pub is putting out free ebooks every single day. They've been doing that for a long time now. And
I had no idea that this was there. And so I went and looked at it. And this is the greatest thing since sliced bread. I love this.
Yeah, I wish I'd let you guys know about this earlier. Albert from the Pie Podcast that I do with, he turned me on to this. And occasionally they'll have, I think last week was a like a gamer attitude for the whole week. They've had an AngularJS one. They had a Maker Week one. And they just do this all the time. Now, these books aren't the most up-to-date. I think most of them are kind of around the realm of 2013, 12, and 14.
You're talking to a guy whose books mainly date from the 90s.
One thing is, if you miss the ebook, there's no going back. You can't somehow find it. You would have to buy it then. But they do it. I believe this is in England. So for where I'm at on the East Coast, I know it's 7 at night. They roll over to the new book. So there's 24 hours for each ebook. You create an account with them or whatever. You download the ebook. And I've gotten a ton of ebooks off of this that have been really helpful. So,
yeah.
I'd highly recommend
One that's up there today is the title is Unity 2D Game Development. Yep. So this is, you know, developing 2D side scrollers using the Unity engine, which is not like the Unity desktop.
Yeah,
right? It's a different deal. But
these topics change all the time, from installing MySQL to Node.js to Raspberry Pi. You name it. It's just something new and different every day. So, I mean, check it out every single day. They got a new ebook. It's free. So,
yeah, it's a great website for, and Packet Publishing is a great source of books generally. I think more than one of the ones that you mentioned, Scott, is a Packet. Like the Linux Mint Essentials is a Packet book.
It is.
Yep. Cool.
And the other website is Android App Addicts. We're just going through my podcast list if nobody's picked up on this occasionally. So I don't have time to surf the Android Play Store or Google Play Store. These guys do. They're part of the network Podnuts. They have other good shows on there as well, but this is one I thought I'd show out to listeners. They review some apps. They let me know what's good. They had one I know. They got two that could stand out on top of my head. There was one that was a craft brew checker. So you basically when you go to the store, you grab your craft brew. If you're not for sure if it's being made by Anheuser-Busch or some other conglomerate and is trying to pan it off that some county in your area actually made it, you just take a picture of the barcode. They'll let you know if it's a craft brew or not immediately. And then they also turned me on to the Kickstarter app, which I figured had been around for a while, but it just helps me to surf on a daily basis. So those are two apps they quickly turned me on to, and they review a bunch of apps. So I just, it helps me not have to go through the store and figure out what I like. They kind of do that stuff for me.
Oh, very cool. Yeah, just what I need are more apps.
Exactly.
My poor Note 2 is just about brain dead now from all the apps on it. So, yeah. So here we got a tip specifically for you, Bill. Am I now? Listen up. Are you paying attention there on the IRC, Bill? This is going to be for you now. Listen up.
Yeah, just like Bill, am I? I'm a big fan of keyboard shortcuts, hotkeys. That's what I call them. I don't know if that's even a term, but that's what I dub them as. Anyway, here is a link for all the listeners. 82 keyboard shortcuts for Linux Mint Cinnamon Edition. I think Bill M.I. uses Mate, but either way, this might convert him over to Cinnamon. I believe this is for Cinnamon 17.2. I'm pretty sure, though, they're going to be prevalent regardless of your version of Mint. Check it out. Just hope everybody likes it. I'm a big fan of these things. I found a few I haven't used.
Bill's always whining about Cinnamon's broken the shortcut things or something. I don't ever know what he's grumbling about, but yeah, they didn't work, I guess. So I guess they must have fixed them. He says, yeah, Cinnamon custom shortcuts didn't work for 3 or 4 distros. So they didn't release, but now they're fixed, I guess. Well, there's 82 of them anyway, so they must have left them alone in a room someplace, and now there's 82 of them. There used to be only 2 or 3, so yeah. Okay, so as far as podcast announcements go, well, we're going to punt and point you over to events.linuxfoundation.org. So you want to know about announcements, get on over there on that internet thing and look them up yourself. We don't know what's going on.
Yeah, there's about 30 odd conferences. I know at my last job when I wanted to go to a conference, they somehow need to know like 5 years in advance so they can pay for it. So this will give you a chance to get a little bit more advanced ahead of the curve for what we got here. Apache. Goodness, how many Apaches do we have? Containers. There's another hot topic. That's always security. Finally, at the bottom. Yeah. There we go.
So I work for an oil company. And so have you seen the price of oil recently? That tells you about which events I'm going to.
Yeah.
So get that gasoline price back up and we'll start talking about events again. Okay, so to round us out here, some acknowledgments for folks who, without whom we would be in dire straits. Kay Wisher for El Picaster has taken on a bit of a Spanish flair there that I'm sure Kevin didn't know about. A little Raspberry Pi that streams our episodes whenever we get around to doing an episode. John Neustetter for the Mumble server that we've been mumbling on for the last hour and 15 minutes and 32 seconds. And, of course, to the Linux Mint development team who have produced this fine distro and who we think were much maligned in the recent events. So we are most appreciative. And I think that's going to come close to doing it for us, guys. Any final parting remarks, comments, thoughts before we bail out of here?
Stop bashing Mint.
Stop bashing Mint. Yeah, come on. Try and behave out there, you guys. It's not that bad a place, really. All right. Well, I am going to hit our button, and we're going to head on out of here, and we'll see you guys all again in, we don't know when. Probably a couple of weeks, something like that. Can't be too long.
This has been another episode of Mintcast. The show notes for this episode are at www.mintcast.org. You can send us email at mintcast@mintcast.org or leave voicemail at +1-832-514-2278. That's 832-514-CAST. You can find more information on Linux Mint at www.linuxmint.com. You can follow both Mintcast and Linux Mint on Twitter at Mintcast and at @Linux_Mint. Thanks to Mark Blasco and Oscar for the podcast music, and thanks for listening to this episode of Mintcast.